Om Vishnu Pad Paramahamsa Padraja Kacharya Rastacharya Sadasu Sriman His Divine Grace A.C. Bhakti Vedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai Nityalila Pravistar Om Vishnu Pad Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Goswami Prabhupada Ki Jai Ananta Kota Vaishnava Vrinda Ki Jai Namacharya Haridas Thakur Ki Jai Premse Kaho Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Suyadvaita Gadadha Shivasadi Gaura Bhakti Vrinda Ki Jai Sri Sri Radha Krishna Gopa Gopinath Shyama Kunda Radha Kunda Giri Gobadan Ki Jai Sri Vrindavan Dham Ki Jai Sri Mathura Dham Ki Jai Sri Navadvip Mayapur Dham Ki Jai Ganga Mayi Ki Jai Jamuna Mayi Ki Jai Bhakti Devi Tulsi Maharani Ki Jai Samaveta Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai Sri Harinam Sankirtan Ki Jai Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai Gaur Premanand All glories to the assembled devotees All glories to the assembled devotees All glories to the assembled devotees all glories to Sri Guru and Gaurambha Om Agyanatimanandasya Gananjana Salakaya Chakshuram Militam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitanya Manovistam Stapitam Jena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Karamayam Dadati Swapadantikam Bandeham Sri Guru Sri Uta Padakamalam Sri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raganatam Vitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadutam Parijana Saitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Sri Visakam Vitam Scha Namarom Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasaya Bhutale Srimate Bhaktivedanta Swaminiti Namine Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nevisesya Sunyavadi Paschacari Shatarine Jaya Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhara Sivasati Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna Krishna Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare Nigama Kalpaturo Galitam Phalam Sukamukaram Ritadrava Samyutam Vibhata Bhagavatam Rasamalayam Mahoda Hoda Sikabhubi Babu Kaha Narayanam Namaskritcha Nanam Cheva Narutamam Devim Saraswatim Vyasam Tato Jayamudhirayat Nashta Prayasu Abhadresu Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya Bhagavati Uttama Slokir Bhaktir Bhavati Naisitki Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya So we're on Canto 4, Text 13, The Descendants of Dhruva Maharaj, and we're doing Text 48 and 49. I think 49 is on the board. So text 48. Vigyaya nevidya gatam patim praja purohita matya surit ganadaya vichikyo uvyam atishoka katara yatani gudam purusham kuyogina. When it was understood that the king had indifferently left home, all the citizens, priests, ministers, friends, and people in general were greatly aggrieved. They began to search for him all over the world, just as a less experienced mystic searches out the super soul within himself. And there's a short purport. The example of searching for the super soul within the heart by the less intelligent mystics is very instructive. The absolute truth is understood in three different features, namely impersonal Brahman, localized Paramatma, and the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Such kuyogina, or less intelligent mystics, can by mental speculation reach the point of the impersonal Brahman, but they cannot find the Supersoul who is sitting within each living entity. When the king left, it was certain that he was staying somewhere else. But because the citizens did not know how to find him, they were frustrated like less intelligent mystics. Text 49. Alakshayanta Padavim Prajapate Atodyama Pratyupasritya Te Purim Rishin Samitan Abhivandya Shasravo Nyavedayan Horava Artri Viplavam Alakshayanta Padavim Prajapate Atojamaha Pratyu Pasrichite Purim Rishin Sametam Abhivandya Shashravo Yavedayan Podava Artri Viplavam Shayanta, not finding Padavim, any trace Prajapate of King Anga, Ata Ujamaha, having become disappointed, Pratyupasritya, after returning, Te. Those citizens, Purim, to the city, Rishin, the great sages, Samitan, assembled, Abhivandya, after making respectful obeisances, Sa Ashrabaha, with tears in their eyes. Nyavedayan, informed. Horava, O Vidura, our tree of the king. Viplavam, the absence. Translation by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. When the citizens could not find any trace of the king after searching for him everywhere, they were very disappointed, and they returned to the city where all the great sages of the country assembled because of the king's absence. With tears in their eyes, the citizens offered respectful obeisances and informed the sages in full detail that they were unable to find the king anywhere. Thus ends the Bhaktivedanta purports of the 4th canto, 13th chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam, entitled Description of the Descendants of Dhruva Maharaj. So, when you gotta go, you gotta go. There's a time, there's a stage in life where you have to simply detach yourself from everything that you've known and everybody you're involved with, and fix yourself with an absolute dedication on the one supreme goal in life. There's many activities, duties, dharmas for different kinds of men. It's all prescribed there in the Varnashram Dharma. But ultimately, the goal is one. Whether you're a Shudra, a Vaishya, a Kshatriya, a Brahmana, it doesn't matter. The goal is to get out of this material world and go back home, back to Godhead. And everybody should be educated in such a way that at the right time, and that right time may be different for different kinds of persons or according to the circumstances, but at the right time, a competent person should know that now I have to go. When you gotta go, you gotta go. And nothing will stop you. So King Anga, of course, as a king, he has more responsibility than most people. As a ruler, you're generally responsible for millions and millions of other living beings, especially human beings, but in the Vedic concept, you're responsible for everybody, all the animals and the birds and the trees and every other living creature that's in your kingdom. So you don't have much time to think about yourself. You're always thinking about the affairs of state. And you can imagine the entanglement that a man's consciousness must be in if he's the head of a state. The monarchs especially take a huge burden upon themselves. There's different kinds of monarchies. There's an absolute monarchy. There's a constitutional monarchy. There's the divine right of kings. There's the mandate from heaven. There's different systems to do with monarchy. The absolute monarchist, he's the man who has all power, state power, religious power, political power. It all rests with one man. That's it. He makes the rules. Everybody else jumps. So that's an absolute monarchist. Then there's a constitutional monarchy, which is a bit more similar to what we'll be reading about here in the Bhagavatam, where the monarch has some power, but he doesn't have absolute power. There's a checks and balance. There's other constituted bodies. There may be an actual constitution written, or there may not be. There may be just some traditional practices which are passed down, which are accepted as constitutional. That's the British system. They don't really have a constitution as such, but there's common law which is passed down from one generation to another, and everybody abides by that, whereas in a place like America, you have a written constitution that everybody has to follow, and it doesn't matter whether you're the head of state or not, you are subject to the constitution. So similarly, a constitutional monarchy, as in England and many other places now, means they have some duties to fulfill as so-called heads of state, but ultimately they are actually under the authority of other bodies. So that became a problem in Europe at one point when there were different bodies challenging the kings for the right to rule their countries. So around about 400 or 500 years ago, they developed the concept of the divine right of kings. In England, it started with James I in about 1603. But the idea of the divine right of kings is that God is the supreme living being and everybody is under his jurisdiction. And the king is directly appointed by God, not by the Pope. Yeah. At that time, there were some competition for political influence between the church and the state. So to get over that, the divine right of kings was developed, which meant that the king was actually appointed directly by God and had no intermediary. So whatever he did was understood or claimed to be the will of God. Whether it was good or bad, nobody was allowed to make that call. Nobody was allowed to make that judgment. He was it, God's representative on earth, and he answered to no one except God himself. So in that way, the divine right of kings, that came in to give the kings a complete surety of power over and above the influence of the religious bodies of the time. And especially the Protestants, they supported that system because it meant that they got out from under the control of the Pope, you know, the Catholic Church. So that was going on. In other places, like in China, for many thousands of years, they had a system of kings, but that was called the mandate from heaven, which was a little bit different from the divine right of kings. They were understood to be in power by the grace of God, but their fitness to rule was actually under question at all times. There was an accepted code of conduct which made a person just and fit to rule over others. And as long as a king abided by those codes, then he had that mandate from heaven and he could not be challenged. His word would be accepted as good as God. However, if he deviated and he began to, you know, unjustly deal with people, then others, and it didn't have to be somebody in another royal line, it could be anybody that was strong enough and just enough, they could challenge the monarch and overthrow him. So in that way, they had different dynasties coming in and out, and everybody accepted the mandate from heaven as long as the king was just. So there was a kind of a checks and balances there. So like that, there's different systems by which a king could rule. So the Vedic system was kind of like a constitutional monarchy in one sense. Although he was understood to be a representative of the Supreme Lord, that's a fact. But at the same time, there were codes of conduct. There was the Dharma Shastras, Arthashastras. There were so many different prescribed duties that were there in the Shastra, which everybody accepted. So the Varnashram system, although it was effected by the power of the king himself did not have absolute say over everything. And we'll see that became the problem with Vena after he was put into power, that after some time he started to think that he was God, or he was as good as God. And at that point then another group had to come in and remove him. And we see that happening here, that after anger has left home, then the citizens, not being able to find him, he concealed himself as the super soul conceals himself within the hearts of every living being, and nobody can find out where he is. In the same way, King Anger went to the forest and disappeared. Nobody knew where he was, so what to do? They were facing a collapse of the political system. Yeah, the order in human society. That means thieves and rogues. And they're always there, that class of men, cheaters. They're always looking for the opportunity to come in and take over, just like in Russia when they switched over from their absolute monarchy, not exactly a monarchy, but their absolute dictatorship, and they tried to become so-called democratic. But what happened was that all the thieves and rogues came sweeping in and immediately took over all the businesses and, you know, all the state mechanisms to use for their own ends. So it's a problem. When you have a ruler, he just disappears off the scene. It leaves a vacuum, and then there's fear in the hearts of the citizens. What will happen next? So somebody's got to come into power, and who will decide who that is? So either they have to fight it out amongst the contenders, or some recognized body can be used to appoint a new ruler. So in the Vedic monarch system, it's more constitutional system, constitutional monarchy. The kings had real power. They were given that power. But there was a body to whom they were responsible. And that was the Brahmins, the Brahminical councils. They had Brahmatejas. They had real power. But they did not involve themselves in the ruling of a country. They preferred to remain aloof because they didn't want to get entangled. They didn't have that tinge of passion which impels a person to get entangled in all kinds of, you know, activities and creative works and machinations and, you know, manipulations of other living beings. That's the mode of passion. When you're in the mode of goodness, you really don't want to get involved in that. You want to be going for something higher. So the Brahmins really didn't get involved that much, but they gave guidance when it was required. So the citizens, not finding the king anymore, knew they were in a precarious position. And so the first thing that they did when they returned was report to the Brahmins, to the sages, that we've looked everywhere, we can't find the king. So we're in a fix now, and so you kindly help us, you give some advice on what is to be done. So that way then, the monarch's position, constitutional monarchy is a nice system. There's checks and balances, but at the same time you have to have some person who is fixed up, who has the ability, the strength, the knowledge, all different opulences he has to have in order to rule over the citizens and make sure that there's order in human society. And if there's no strong leader, then you have havoc. That was Arjuna's concern, that we're going to kill all the kings. Yeah, we're going to have this massive battle. Every king on the planet is assembled for it. Yeah. 18 Akshauhini divisions of soldiers, yeah, big kings, small kings, all the rulers, and he knew we're going to kill the lot, everybody. So what will happen? All these leaders of men, after they're killed, then all the citizens will be thrown into disruption. Their social systems will be thrown into disruption, and unscrupulous men will take advantage. And then you'll have all kinds of unwanted progeny as a result, just as Vena was an unwanted progeny in one sense. Of course, his father wanted a son, but he didn't get the son that he wanted. Right, he wanted a son, but he didn't get the son that he wanted. So in that way then, he became disgusted and decided that my time here is finished. Because you might think from one point of view, you know, what is he doing? He's got so much responsibility, and before his time, he's giving it up and just disappearing. You know, he's deserting the citizens. He's culpable. Yeah, of course, he's likely to be criticized for that, naturally so. You know, if somebody's in a very responsible position with so many people depending upon him, and then he just disappears in the middle of the night and you never see him again, what will everybody think about it? Yeah, there's a lot of social pressure there to continue on doing your duty. But King Anga, he saw the bigger duty, the higher duty, And he realized that he had come to a point where his ordinary duties could not be fulfilled correctly anymore. He was unable to correct his son, who was the heir to the throne. He knew what was going to happen. As soon as he retires, Vena comes in. He's going to do so many horrible deeds. He's already been doing them right practically from birth. As soon as he could walk and talk, he began to punish, his playmates. You can imagine what kind of a situation they were in with this ferocious character, Vena. He was the grandson of death personified. So he thought nothing about killing somebody if they didn't please him. But he was the king's son, so the other children had to come and play with him. And they knew if we go and play with Vena, we may be killed. Yeah, we may be butchered by him if we displease him. But if we don't go and play with him, he'll kill us anyway. Because he's going to be the king. So it was a very difficult situation. And the father, anger, he knew what's going to happen to the country when I leave and this person, this boy takes over. Yeah, this is very difficult. So he tried to correct him in so many different ways, but nothing worked. He had this, demonic characteristic. So at a certain point, he realized that I can't do anything anymore. I cannot rule effectively anymore. Things have gone out of my hand. So if I can't save everybody else, at least I should save myself. So he made a decision to just disappear. And off he went. And that was the last anybody ever saw of him. Because he was a devotee. So when he left, he took up his devotional service full time and he went back to Godhead. That was his qualification as a Raja Rishi. The kings were not just politically powerful, but they were spiritually powerful also. They were educated in all the principles of Dharma, Artha, Karma, and Moksha. So they knew, and he knew. Now, at this end of life, I have to go and fulfill my spiritual duties. But then that left a vacuum, and that had to be fulfilled. And he was depending on God for that. Not having the power himself to correct the situation, then he left that responsibility to Krishna, to God, and to the actual representatives of God, the Brahmins, the sages. And he figured that they're powerful enough that they'll deal with it. I can't deal with it, but they will. So he had no real qualms about going. The time was right. And he recognized the time is right. As we've talked about time before, time means the superior control. And in the material world, the superior control, time, it's the impersonal energy of the Supreme Lord. But in the spiritual sense, time is Krishna himself, personally. So the right time. When Krishna calls, when Krishna decides for a devotee, then he goes, that's all. He lets go of everything. He realizes this is all futile anyway, being in the material world, this material body. So now the time has come, let it go. Yeah, and it's very fortunate if you can be in a situation where you're able to let go. Now, anger, he was not really in that situation. He wanted to let everything go, cut the bonds of his relationships with everybody and everyone. But he was not really in a situation where he was able to do that by remaining as a king. Everybody else didn't want to let him go. That was the problem. So this phenomena was studied in the 1960s. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, she was a doctor, psychologist. She did a study on people that were about to die in the hospitals. And they noticed that there was a progression of different emotions that they went through. That when a person's first told that they're going to die, they deny it. They actually, it's a shock, they can't believe it. Me? I'm going to die? I always thought that was going to be tomorrow. And then all of a sudden they're told, no, it's coming right now. And they're not prepared because they're so entangled in the external world. So internally they're not prepared, and so they go into a state of denial. But the condition persists, and then they become angry. Why me? Yeah, I have some, what have I done to deserve this? You know, some horrible foul disease or some accident or whatever it may be, but what have I done to deserve it? They get angry. Why is God punishing me like this? I haven't done anything wrong. Yeah. And then after the anger stage, they get to a kind of a balancing or bargaining stage where they start to kind of accept that they can't avoid the inevitable. But still, they have plans and they have schemes and they have relationships that they're involved in, and so they want to do something, you know, to kind of smooth them out, you know, bring them to a nice conclusion. Just give me 4 more years so I can finish all my plans and set the family affairs in order, and then I'll happily go. Just give me 4 more years. That was one of Prabhupada's clients in Allahabad. So like that, there's this kind of bargaining stage. And then when he realizes, or the person realizes, that they can't even bargain, you know, this is an absolute fact, you are going to die whether you finish your plans or not, you're a dead man, that's it, then they get very depressed. Oh, now I'm defeated. All the plans and schemes have all gone. I have nothing. Nobody can save me. Just depression. No future. You know, no aspirations. Everything finished. And then after that, they may, if they're fortunate, come to the point where they just accept it. Yeah. Oh yes, this is part of life. You get a material body. It's got built-in obsolescence. It lasts for a certain period. Everybody has to die. Nobody is going to live in these bodies more than a certain period of time. Fine. I accept it. Whatever comes next, I accept it. Let me go. And then they become very peaceful in their hearts, and off they go. But one of the other symptoms that these researchers noticed was that even if the person themselves comes to the point of acceptance, they get hampered by the family members who don't want them to accept it. No, you've got to keep on fighting. Keep on fighting. Yeah. No, take this medicine. Oh, try this doctor. Here, try this cure. Oh, I met somebody that had the same thing as you. Here, try this. Come on. Why don't you want to try it? So they harass them. You can't leave us. You're supporting us. We depend on you. How can you leave us? Like this. So it makes it very difficult and very complex. I just... one of my godbrothers in Australia, he just got the news 3 days ago that he's got stomach cancer. It's very aggressive. He hasn't been able to eat for about 6 months. He was in the hospital 4 times. They didn't find anything. And then they were just telling him it's just dyspepsia, indigestion. Right? Now after 6 months, finally, he insisted that they do proper tests. And they've discovered that his esophagus is half eaten, it's gone into his stomach, it's gone into his lymph glands, like this, so his whole system now is riddled with it. So who knows how long he's got left. So that was just 3 days ago he found out about that. I was just speaking with him this morning. So he said one of the problems he's got right now, he said, whatever Krishna wants, I'm going to accept. He said, I'm just, you know, there'll be more tests and I'll make a decision on what to try to do after that. But he said, you know, I understand it's Krishna's arrangement. But he said, the problem is, he said, my phone doesn't stop ringing. All day and all night, people are ringing me up. My family, parents are freaking out. You know, my kids are freaking out. I just got a granddaughter now, my first granddaughter. So they want me to come and stay with them and blah, blah, blah. So like this, it's becoming complicated and he's becoming a bit bewildered, you know, by the clamor that's around him. So, you know, it's not an easy thing to get to this stage of detachment, even when you're trained in it. But still, there are many complications. It's not, you know, a thing that you do lightly. You know, it takes a hero, actually, to be able to cut everything off like that and just detach themselves and fully accept and put themselves in the hands of God. Yeah, it takes an elevated soul to be able to do that. Srila Prabhupada, of course, he did the same thing in one sense as King Anger. Yeah, he had his family. And then at a certain point, he had done his best. You know, because there were some kinds of devotees, but they were not really interested in the higher goal in life that Srila Prabhupada had been pursuing. He had a duty to perform. He had a mission that was given to him by his spiritual master. And that was his heart and soul. So at a certain point, Prabhupada realized his family is not going to help him in that mission anymore. His wife wasn't interested. His kids weren't interested. And they were, at a certain point, a hindrance to the fulfillment of his instructions. There was a certain point at which Prabhupada realized that. Yeah, you got to do what you got to do. He actually told us he was given that instruction in 1922 by the Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati when he first met him at Altadingi, at that house there. And then he said, but I couldn't do that for about 30 or 40 years because he said I was just a newly married man at that time. So I heard the instruction and I accepted it. And I was always thinking how to do it. But he said, in the meantime, I was making so many adjustments because I was a family man, so I had to make so many adjustments. So in that way, he said, 30, 40 years passed making adjustments till I finally took it up seriously. So I was with Prabhupada in Hawaii in May of 76, and I was giving him his evening massage. Prabhupada was lying on the bed. I was sitting next to him and massaging his legs and feet. And he started laughing. He was like chuckling. So I looked, you know, I looked at him, and Prabhupada, he was laughing. He said, "You know my story?" He said, "How I left home." I said, "No, Srila Prabhupada." Because Prabhupada was bringing it up. I was thinking he would tell me. I knew the story, actually. But I wanted to hear it from Srila Prabhupada. So he said, "Tea or me?" He said, "You know that story?" So I said, "No." So then Prabhupada told me, he said, "Yes." He said, "I went home." He said, "My wife, she had sold my Bhagavatams for some tea biscuits," like that. So he said, at that moment, he said, "I told her," I said, "I became very angry, and I told her," I said, "now you have to choose. You choose your husband or your tea, but you can't have both." So she thought I was joking. So she said, "Oh, then I'll have my tea." So he said, that was it. He said, a few days later, he said, "I borrowed 10 rupees from a friend, and I left, and I never came back." I said, "Where did you go?" He said, "Anywhere." So he borrowed 10 rupees, but that was it. That was the, you know, the proverbial straw that broke the camel's back. Prabhupada tolerated so many inconveniences to his preaching mission for so many years by his entanglement in his family duties. He was a dutiful person. But at a certain point, that moment came, you know, the cutoff point where he had to make that decision. He knew, this is it. Now, if I don't get out now, I'll never do it. So he made the choice and off he went, and he never came back. Of course, Prabhupada didn't disappear into the forest and was never seen again, you know. But off he went, and he cut off all bonds with his family. But that did not mean that they accepted it. It's not that the, you know, the struggle was over. He just walked out the door and everybody was happy. Quite the contrary. Prabhupada went off. He went to Jhansi. Then he went to Mathura. Then he moved to Radha Damodar. He took sannyas in 1959. So he was away from home 6-7 years at least, from that incident to when he walked out to when he actually took sannyas. And he had not been home. But yet when he took sannyas, He heard later, his family informed him that when we heard you took sannyas, it was like a thunderbolt to us. So somehow or another, even though he'd not been home for years, they still were thinking, he's our provider, he's our supplier, you know, he's our father or husband or whatever, like that. So the bonds of affection, and or maybe not even affection, but some bond of attachment was still there. But Prabhupada was sitting in Vrindavan, writing his Vrindavan Bhajan. What is these family members? Just a list of names. Yeah, he wrote a very long poem. That was just at the time when he took sannyas. That was Prabhupada's mood. He was divesting himself. He was, you know, rubbing his name off the list. Yeah, and he was entering into Krishna's family. But his, you know, material family, let's say, his physical family, yeah, they couldn't accept it. So the youngest son, Vrindavan Chandra, he was sent several times to go and live with Srila Prabhupada even after he took sannyas. Not because the family wanted him to be trained up as a brahmachari, but because they didn't want the financial burden of having him in the home. Prabhupada wasn't there anymore. The burden of responsibility fell on his second son, M.M. Day, Mathura Mohan. But Mathura Mohan was a bit of a rascal. He didn't want that responsibility, and from that time on he became deeply resentful towards his father for having saddled him with the burden of looking after the family. So he really didn't like it, and nor would he get a job. So they were actually starving, or they were in difficulty. So they sent the youngest son to stay with Prabhupada, even after he took sannyas. You know, when Prabhupada was staying in Delhi at that place there, I forget the name now. So Prabhupada said, all right, you can stay with me if you live like a brahmachari. But he couldn't, so Prabhupada sent him back. So then again they sent him, and again Prabhupada told him, you live like a brahmachari, you're welcome, otherwise you go. So again he went back. So like this, Prabhupada told me, two or three times they sent this younger boy to be with him. Then finally, you know, it was settled. Prabhupada was in the Radha Damodar. He began writing his books. He was getting revelations. Yeah, you know, he had personal instructions from Jiva Goswami, Rupa Goswami, Sanatan Goswami, from his spiritual master, whilst he was writing. So in this way, Prabhupada was completely out of the material world. He was in Radha Damodar, the most spiritual place on the planet, yeah, and about to start his mission. And he was getting this instruction and inspiration on what he had to do. Even then it didn't finish. Even then it didn't finish. But Prabhupada went to the West. He went with the determination, I'm never coming back to India. He told us that. He said, I was so disgusted with India, with the state of, you know, the society in India and how degraded it had become, how everybody was so cheating and, you know, nobody could be trusted, nobody was interested in the spiritual heritage anymore. So he was completely disgusted. He tried for so many years to, you know, start something but couldn't. Then when he went to the West, then within a year after struggle, he got some following. He saw how enthusiastic these young boys and girls were from the West. So he made a determination, I'm just going to stay here and preach. This is my spiritual master's mission fulfilled. I, you know, started spreading all over the world. So that was Prabhupada's determination. I just read a letter the other day where I think it was about early 1970, where Prabhupada was writing, I just forget who to, one of his disciples, and he said, I'm not coming, I have no interest in going back to India. I'm completely disgusted with that. I'm doing nicely here. This is where my work is. And yet, in August of 1970, the same year, Prabhupada did come back to India. And there was a certain series of events which triggered that, where some leading members in Los Angeles began what Prabhupada later called a great sinister conspiracy to put him in the background and basically, you know, improve their own influence in the society, ISKCON society. and it became so fraught that Prabhupada in July of 1970, he called some of his trusted men. Tamal Krishna was in Europe at that time, so he was called from Europe, and Bhagavan was called, and Hayagriva was called, Kirtananda was called to LA, and then he told them, this conspiracy is going on, get me out of here. So Tamal Krishna Maharaj asked him, well, shall we go to, let's go to Florida. Prabhupada said, no, not far enough. So then they said, well, let's go to Europe. Prabhupada said, no, not far enough. So all right, we'll think about it. So then Prabhupada made the decision to go back to India. So in August, he gave sannyas to a number of men. About half a dozen men took sannyas in the last week of July, and another three or four in early August. And Prabhupada set off from Los Angeles. He flew to Japan first. And he went to Japan to meet with the executives of Dai Nippon Company so that he could negotiate the printing of his Bhagavatam in a very first-class manner. So that was still his main concern, was his books. So he dealt with that first. He went there with four sannyasis, and Sudama was already there preaching. And then from there, at the end of August, Prabhupada flew into Calcutta. And as soon as he landed, because the Chutananda was here and a couple of others, they met him at the airport, and immediately it was huge news in all the newspapers. It was a sensation that Bhaktivedanta Swami from Calcutta has arrived with four Western sannyasis. He's preaching Krishna consciousness all over the world. He has so many temples. It was a sensation. Because when Prabhupada came back the first time to India in 1967, he came back for his health. And he was doing a little inquiring, you know, but things weren't ready at that time. They weren't ripe. Yeah. So he came back again at the end of the year. And as I say, he had this idea of not going back to India. But in 1970, in August, he did come back and he began preaching. And as soon as he arrived, it was a sensation. Then they set up this big pandal that they had at Dasapriya Park. 20, 30,000 people a night were coming. It was, you know. Then they went over to Bombay. They did the Cross Maidan pandal. They did Delhi, you know, Gorakhpur, Surat, all these different places. Prabhupada was running from one place to another. Sometimes he was doing four programs a day. It was a sensation. And what happened? As soon as he arrived in Calcutta, his family sent him a solicitor's letter demanding that he pay them 3 lakhs of rupees because he had made them destitute. He had acted cruelly. He had left them and abandoned them, and criticizing him in so many ways that you've left us destitute. Your poor wife is suffering, living on the street. It was a letter that M.M. Day actually had written, but he had a solicitor send it to his ex-father, Srila Prabhupada, demanding money. So still they were not letting go. They couldn't appreciate Prabhupada's preaching. They couldn't appreciate the wonderful activities that he was doing all over the world. What they wanted was some money. That's all. They still wanted to keep that bond, yeah, that obligation, that duty. So Prabhupada, whilst he was in the middle of starting ISKCON in India, this phenomena, he had to still deal with this business. So don't think that it's easy to give up, one's attachments in this material world. It's not. You actually have to have some special favor from Krishna to be able to walk out of those situations, give it up, and just fix yourself completely on the lotus feet of the Lord and go back home, back to Godhead. There are so many entanglements, so many things to keep us and hold us. So how exalted was King Anga? Yeah. Rather than that he be criticized for abandoning the citizens, he's glorified actually in the Bhagavatam because he achieved the real goal in life, which was not to be a king, but it was to go back home, back to Godhead. So in this way then, anyway, we can see how things are progressing. Still, of course, that leaves a situation in the kingdom that still has to be dealt with. So many other living beings, they have to be cared for and kept on the path. So that's coming up in the next chapter, how the sages finally deal with that through their situation in a constitutional monarchy. Okay, so we'll finish at that point. Does anybody have any questions or comments? Yes, Prabhupada. Use the microphone.
Hare Krishna. Prabhu, what?
Speak loudly.
What was the conspiracy against Prabhupada?
What was the conspiracy against Srila Prabhupada? It wasn't exactly directly against Prabhupada. Indirectly it was. Prabhupada traced it back to some contamination that came in through his disciples in India. At that time, ISKCON was not in India, but there were some disciples that were here in India, and they got contaminated by their association with some envious godbrothers, Prabhupada's godbrothers. And what it came back in the form of, it became like a Mayavad understanding, like a misunderstanding of Prabhupada's position. There was some manipulation of Prabhupada's position in Los Angeles. Some of his leading disciples, they began to censor his mail. They started to go through the letters that he was receiving and decide which ones he could see and which ones he couldn't see. There was other hints of a kind of a minimization of Prabhupada's position. They left his titles off his, there was a print run that was done at ISKCON Press. They left off the title, His Divine Grace, and Prabhupada. They just put Bhaktivedanta Swami. There were many things. There were lots of symptoms that were building up. And Prabhupada could understand that some of his leading disciples had become, philosophically poisoned. And they were minimizing his position. And, of course, their own material ambitions, they were not advanced devotees by any means. So that was starting to come to the fore. So Prabhupada, made a number of maneuvers, if you like, or rectification. One of them was that the four main men that were involved, he gave them sannyas, because at that time, sannyasis, Prabhupada's rule was that sannyasis were not allowed to be involved in management. They should just preach. Yeah? It wasn't until 1972 when Prabhupada changed that. But before that, a sannyasi was just meant for preaching. The householders did all the management. So Prabhupada gave these four men sannyas. That immediately pulled them out of their position of management. And it effectively, took them out from their ability, cut their ability to manipulate things. But even then, after that, then they developed this philosophy that when they, the following month, they went to Janmashtami celebration in New Vrindavan. And Prabhupada had actually been meant to go there, but because of this business, he left for Japan earlier in the month, in August. Then they had the Janmashtami festival, and Prabhupada was receiving reports from his GBC men. Now, that was the other thing that Prabhupada did, was that he gave sannyas to these four men around about the 22nd to 20. It was on, I think, Gadadhar Pandit's appearance day, late July. And then about 5 or 6 days afterwards, Prabhupada formed the GBC body. He constituted officially the GBC body and put them in charge of the society. And their first business was to go to New Vrindavan, where these four sannyasis went for the Janmashtami festival. And these men started to preach that actually Prabhupada has left America because he's disgusted with all of his disciples. We're all offenders. We've all insulted him. So he's left us and he's not coming back. Everybody became depressed, naturally. More than depressed. And then they started preaching, actually the reason why we've offended him is because we failed to recognize that Prabhupada is Krishna himself. Yeah, Mayavad. So they began to preach this Mayavad philosophy. But other the new GBC members, some of them were there, so they started reading Prabhupada's books, you know, very rapidly, and then they countered this false philosophy. And Prabhupada was reported, it was reported to him in Japan. And then Prabhupada said, yes, very good. This is the GBC's business. So he consulted with the four sannyasis that were with him, four other sannyasis that were with him in Japan. And Sudama was one of the first GBC members. And they came to the conclusion that these men should be kicked out of ISKCON. So Prabhupada said, yes, good decision. So they rang that back to New Vrindavan. And these four men were immediately thrown out of the society. Prabhupada didn't reject them as disciples, but he kicked them out of his temples. They weren't allowed in any ISKCON temple. Then afterwards, they realized their mistake and they rectified it. It took a couple of months. But then they rectified it, then immediately he brought them back in again. But he traced this. He said it was a conspiracy that was started by some of his envious godbrothers in India that didn't like the fact that he had, you know, become so big as an acharya and that he had accepted the name of Prabhupada. That was one of the big sticking points. Anyway, it's a big history. Some of that, you can read that in the Prabhupada Lilamrita. But that was the conspiracy. So, you know, I mean, Srila Prabhupada had to face so many difficulties in getting this society up and running, constituting it properly, organizing the managerial system, checks and balances, yeah, to stop it from fragmenting in the way that he has seen his spiritual master's mission fragmented. Immediately within 1 year of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati's disappearance, the entire Gaudiya mission was finished. It was shattered into pieces. So Prabhupada had it in his mind. And these, you know, this conspiracy thing was one reason why he was very careful to set up a GBC body. He knew what was coming, so he wanted to get something in place where the management and the philosophy would be preserved in a proper order, so that, you know, everybody could take advantage of what he had set up and what he had given us in his books and through his, you know, active preaching work, the system of sadhana that Prabhupada set up for us. Prabhupada was super intelligent. He was a superman. There's no question. Yeah. Last question. No question, last question.
Hare Krishna, Prabhu.
Loudly.
Thank you for a very nice class. This may not be directly connected to the class, the question. But we have some very nice devotees in the West, you know, who follow like everything, the, you know, the principles and senior devotees and, I mean, leaders, but who have like maybe, you know, not visited India for a long time, right, for you know, maybe a span of like 8 years, 10 years, you know, 15 maybe. But then we know that Prabhupada wanted leaders to visit India regularly, the holy dhams, Vrindavan and Mayapur. So as far as I understand, maybe these devotees think that, you know, we are very busy with our service and we are following the whole process very nicely. So perhaps, like, perhaps they think that, you know, this is a higher principle, that we are serving in separation.
Yes. So what's your question?
So the question is that, is it okay?
Is it okay if devotees don't come to India? Right?
Yeah.
I'll answer that in two ways. In 1973 or 74, Prabhupada sent a letter to all the devotees through the temples saying that every year he wanted as many devotees as possible to come to Mayapur and Vrindavan for the Gaur Purnima festival. In 1977, when book distribution was booming, it was phenomenally huge, millions of dollars were coming in. There was a question that was raised by Rameshwara Swami. He was the BBT trustee in North America. He came in 77 for the festival here. And he asked Srila Prabhupada, he said, you know, generally all the devotees want to come, you know, for the Mayapur festival. But if we allowed that, he said, first of all, he said, just like now, there's 300 devotees that have come from America. Each one of them, that means they spent over $1,000 just on the ticket. That's $300,000. Plus the spending money when they get here. Plus the 3 or 4 weeks that they're away, no books are being distributed. So that's costing us at least another, you know, $300,000 for the period that they're not selling books and making a contribution to the BBT. So this festival's costing us $600,000 or $700,000. So we thought that, you know, we can let a few devotees come, you know, on a like 3-yearly or 5-yearly basis. And in that way, we can keep the book distribution going and we can, you know, save money. And he was sure that Prabhupada would say, yes, the books must keep on going out. We must save the money. And Prabhupada said, no, as many as possible should come. That was it. He didn't care what the cost was, yeah, what the material, sorry, not material cost, but he understood and he said, everybody should come to Vrindavan and Mayapur every year. You're out preaching, you know, in the West or in other countries, the Far East or whatever, Middle East, whatever it is. And, you know, it's a material atmosphere. So the tendency is you get, you know, some tinge of materialism. You get affected by it. You start thinking it's normal, you know, the way that Westerners live. And, you know, there's a kind of a contamination. So by coming to Mayapur and Vrindavan every year, just by being in the holy Dham, having the association, that purifies you of that contamination that you might pick up in the course of your preaching activities, you know, all around the world. So Prabhupada wanted us to come, you know, to India, particularly Vrindavan and Mayapur, and take advantage of the facilities that are here to get purified. At the same time, it is also, he affirmed, it's a spiritual fact that wherever you're performing devotional service, if you're doing it sincerely, that is Vrindavan, that is Mayapur. I have a god sister, Rasagya. So she left the body a couple of years ago. So actually her husband previously, some 10 years or so ago, Loitaxa Prabhu, he had gotten very sick. He only had a very short period of time to remain. So at the last moment, even though actually he was not fit to travel, she got him on an aeroplane, she brought him to Vrindavan, and after 7 days he left his body in Vrindavan. So very fortunate. So, you know, she knew the importance of being in Vrindavan, you know, especially to leave your body, or Mayapur, to leave your body. So she got cancer, and she was very, very sick, not much association. One god sister came and was looking after her. And there was that question, should they bring her to India? Should they bring her to Vrindavan or Mayapur? And she had a dream, and Prabhupada told her in a dream, Vrindavan is in your heart. So that was it. She stayed where she was, I think in Austin, Texas. Yeah. And she left the body in the company of devotees chanting, you know, and left very successfully. So, internally, Vrindavan is everywhere. Krishna is everywhere, and wherever Krishna is, that's where Vrindavan is. So if we can tune into that, it doesn't matter where we are. Bhaktitirtha Maharaj is another good example. He understood that perfectly. That's why he didn't bother coming back to India. He stayed at Gita Nagari because he wanted to show the devotees that you don't have to be, you know, you don't have to come over to India, Vrindavan or Mayapur to leave your body. You can be successful wherever you are because devotional service is pure. Yeah, and wherever it's performed, that's where Radha and Krishna are. So you can take your pick. You can come or not come, depending on the state of your consciousness. Personally, I have to live in India. I hate living in the West. I can't. You know, I get into too much trouble when I go into the West. So I just go for short visits and come back. I need to live in Mayapur and Vrindavan. Oh, you know, Mayapur, actually. I'm a Mayapur Wala. I hope. I mean, I hope Lord Chaitanya accepts me as a Mayapur Wala. I'm hanging in as much as I can. But if one is strong in devotional service, you can be anywhere, and that's Vrindavan. Just like Srila Prabhupada created Vrindavan everywhere he went. Yeah, he installed so many deities. Why do you think that Radha and Krishna have agreed to appear in so many different places all around the world? Next month, I'm going to Sydney. It's the 40th anniversary of the appearance of Radha Gopinath in Sydney. So they were installed in 1971. So 1971, Prabhupada started installing many, many sets of deities in different places around the world. So when Prabhupada installed Radha Gopinath in Sydney, he told us, what he did was actually he initiated everybody that was in the temple. There were some devotees that had been in the temple for 3 days. Yeah? 3 days, and Prabhupada initiated everybody that was in the temple. Because it was his first visit, he could see they need some kind of a boost. And he installed Radha Gopinath. There was not a single initiated Brahmin in the whole yatra. Because the whole yatra was about 15 or 16 people, that was it. Only Bali Mahadan, because he was an older devotee, and Upendra was there. But apart from that, locally, there were no initiated Brahmins. So Prabhupada gave double initiations, you know, to one or two devotees, and they were designated to look after the deities. And then afterwards, Prabhupada said, when he left, he prayed to Radha Gopinath that now I'm leaving you in the hands of these malachas and yavanas. They don't know anything. So you have to look after yourself. Right? You have to give them the... I'm leaving you here, now you have to give them the intelligence how to serve you nicely. So the following year he came back, and you know, by that time there was about 45 people in the temple. That was in Glebe in Sydney. They'd just built a very nice, beautiful altar, and the puja was going on very nicely. When Prabhupada came, he was so happy to see how Radha Gopinath were looking after themselves. And he told us that story, that this is how I prayed. So, you know, Prabhupada had this relationship with Krishna, that Krishna was agreeing, you know, to appear in different places around the world just on Prabhupada's say-so. Yeah, not because of our devotion, because of Prabhupada's devotion. And he was creating these little Vrindavans all over the planet. All we have to do is, you know, maintain, you know, the standards that Prabhupada's given us, and we're in Vrindavan. That's all. Wherever it may be, but Vrindavan's actually in your heart. Answer your question? Alright. It's very... He's asking, when will the Transcendental Diary be completed? That's my book. Well, my diary only begins from November 1975. I've got 5 volumes out that covers the first year. I'm supposed to be working on volume 6. I've got half of it done. That goes from December and January of 77. December 76, January 77. I'd like to be able to say it'll be out this year, but I've been saying that for the last 5 years, so nobody believes me anymore. I'll work on it. And then there's one after that. But this story about Radha Gopinath, you can read that in Korma Prabhu's book. You know Korma, the famous Australian chef. So he's written a book, The Great Transcendental Adventure. And that's the history of Krishna consciousness coming to Australia. Australia was very fortunate. Prabhupada visited there every year from 1971 to 1976. six times, even though it's down under, so far away from everywhere else. Yeah, but Prabhupada went there six times. So that's, you know, it's a wonderful book, and the whole history is there. And there are, of course, many other books that are coming out. Mukunda Maharaj's book's just come out about the early days. Miracle on Second Avenue. And Rancho Prabhu came out, Where the Sun Shines, his book about London, the starting of the Yatra there. And I think every center, especially Los Angeles, New York, these places where Prabhupada spent so much time, they should have had books out about Prabhupada's times there years and years ago. And so anybody that's listening to this class that happens to be in Los Angeles,